Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll revisit our conversation from March of 2023 with Rebecca Boggs Roberts, author of the biography Untold Power: The Fascinating Rise and Complex Legacy of First Lady Edith Wilson. While this nation has yet to elect its first woman president, and though history has downplayed her role, just over a century ago, a woman became the nation's first acting president. In fact, she was born in 1872. Her name was Edith Bowling Galt Wilson. She climbed her way out of Appalachian poverty and into the highest echelons of American power, and in 1919 effectively acted as the first woman president of the U.S. before women could even vote nationwide when her husband Woodrow Wilson was incapacitated. Hope you join us for this discussion following the news.
This episode of Access Utah was originally broadcast in March of 2023.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest today is Rebecca Boggs Roberts. She's an award-winning educator, author, speaker, also leading historian of the American women's suffrage and civic participation. And the new book is a very interesting book. It's called Untold Power: The Fascinating Rise and Complex Legacy of First Lady Edith Wilson. Just a little bit about the book. While this nation has yet to elect its first woman president, and though history has downplayed her role, just over a century ago, a woman became the nation's first acting president. And so we want to talk about Edith Wilson on the program today. So Rebecca Boggs Roberts, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start a little bit with your biography, which is maybe one of the most interesting I've ever read, your short biographical statement. Things like radio host, jazz singer, forensic anthropologist, how did you fit all that in?
Well, I'm glad you think that it's interesting and it doesn't make me a dilettante. I think there is a little bit of a through line there. I think tour guide, producer, it's all about storytelling in various forms. So throughout my somewhat checkered career, I've just tried to find a way to tell human stories, and whether that's by studying their skeletons or singing about them or writing their biographies or interviewing people on radio talk shows, which we all know is a terrible thing to do. I think that it's just been a way of exploring, you know, the stories of human nature.
And I guess a very interesting ancestry, if you put it that way. I know NPR listeners will recognize the name of your mother, Cokie Roberts.
Yes. Mom, who we lost just a couple of years ago, very familiar to radio listeners and someone I miss absolutely every day.
And your grandmother, Lindy Boggs. Some people will recognize her name.
Yes, my grandmother, Lindy Boggs, was the first woman elected to Congress from the state of Louisiana. She was also the ambassador to the Vatican in the Clinton administration, a just really fabulous, wonderful lady who happily we got until she was 97. So she lived a nice long life.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Edith Wilson, I guess for someone who's written about women's suffrage, might be a strange thing. Might be a strange connection. How did you come upon Edith Wilson? Because I'll just say here, and you can expand here. Edith Wilson was not a supporter of women's suffrage, right?
She was anti-suffrage, which just kills me in retrospect, because she was this interesting, independent, wealthy trailblazer in so many ways, and she smashed so many barriers, but for some reason did not think that women needed to exercise their full rights as citizens. But I actually got interested in her through suffrage, oddly, because I'd written a couple books on the suffrage movement. I was giving a lot of talks in the year leading up to the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. And somehow, inevitably, really regardless of audience, regardless of where I was, the venue, someone would ask me about Edith Wilson. And people wondered if maybe, because Woodrow Wilson had dragged his feet on supporting the 19th Amendment, maybe he changed his mind in 1918 because she had whispered in his ear. Maybe it was actually her influence that that had led him to come around to federal support of suffrage, which is totally not true. He mainly came around to support the 19th Amendment for reasons of electoral math, and she was never a supporter. But I started looking into her story because those questions were coming really predictably. I really wanted to be better prepared for them. And I discovered that her story remains largely untold, or told only in bits and pieces. People tend to concentrate on the time of her life when she was first lady, when she did sort of seize the reins of executive power when Woodrow Wilson had a stroke. And I understand why people pay attention to that chapter. It's completely fascinating. But it's, you know, just a tiny part of her life. And she is a, you know, complex, full human, and her actions at that moment can really be better understood in context if you know more about her.
She did, I think, write a memoir, but some chapters were suppressed or weren't published. You can say it better.
Yeah, she did. She was the first lady to write a memoir. Now, you know, we sort of expect all first ladies that a couple of years after they've left the White House, their memoir will hit the shelf. But she was the first, and she wrote it. I think everyone in that administration wrote a memoir. There is no shortage of first-person narratives of the World War One era and the Wilson administration. And most of them made Edith Wilson mad. She thought that they mischaracterized events, that they didn't paint her or her husband in the light she wanted them to be painted in. And so she wrote that memoir sort of in a fury, or at least started it in a fury on a train one day. And it was published in 1939. 15 years after Woodrow Wilson had died. And she wrote it very much to set the record straight in her mind. So it's to be taken with a grain of salt. It's a delightful read. It's very frank and funny, but it's also in places demonstrably untrue. And so you have to take Edith as an unreliable narrator, even of her own life. But that memoir ends the day Wilson died in 1924. And I found that sort of amazing, that Edith's memoir ended the day her husband died, as if her life didn't exist after that. And it turned out she did write more chapters, but her publisher didn't think anyone would be interested in them. And so they were never published. And as I started doing research into Edith's life and story, the people who hold the rights to that memoir, which are the people who own the house she was born in and run the Edith Bowling Wilson Birthplace Museum, told me that, in fact, there were these unpublished chapters. And once I kind of earned their trust, they let me have them. So that's like the holy grail to historians, unpublished first-person narrative of the person you are writing a biography about. And no one had ever had access to them before. So that was a real treat. I will say they don't have any smoking gun in them. It's not like you read those unpublished chapters and she's saying, you know, ha-ha, not do it again, and, you know, next stop the Kremlin or something. But they do help you understand her better because it's just more of her voice.
I do want to, you know, kind of go back chronologically, get her childhood and go forward, but it struck me she had a good long life. Died in 1961, met President Kennedy, right?
Right. She died at 89. So she lived 37 years as Woodrow Wilson's widow.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. So tell me about her beginnings. 1872, born, right? Tell me about her family.
She was born in Wytheville, Virginia. Wytheville is in southwest Virginia in the foothills of Appalachia, and that was not her ancestral home. Her family had been tobacco planters in the James River Valley. They held slaves. When the Civil War happened and they had to, you know, pay their labor, the plantation economics no longer worked for them, and they gave up that land. And they moved to this kind of funny little rabbit warren of rooms over storefronts on Main Street in Wytheville. And Edith was the sixth of nine kids, and her parents and both her grandmothers and various aunts and uncles and some cousins and other hangers-on. So those rooms above Main Street were cramped. And she easily could have gotten lost in that shuffle. She was raised in those kind of lost cause myths that the family was grander than their current circumstances would allow, They were descended from Pocahontas, a descent they took very seriously. In fact, Edith delineates all nine generations of descent in her memoir. And she was, you know, in this mess of children and was getting lessons from her mother and her mother's mother that women should be proper Southern Victorian ideal women, that they should be pious and pure and domestic and submissive, and all the sort of cult of true womanhood ideal that dominated that region in that era for girls of her class. And then contrastingly, from her father's mother, she was sort of singled out as a favorite. And that grandmother told her that she was strong and she should be confident and she should trust her own opinions and she shouldn't be afraid to voice them. And I don't want to do a whole lot of psychoanalysis of Edith Wilson 150 years after her birth, but I do think that a lot of the contradictions that really marked her adult life, where she showed one face in public and did contrasting things in private, can be traced back to those competing grandmother lessons. She was definitely by nature more bent towards the confident strength, but she was being told to cloak it in this striving for this submissive piety. And even if she never really reached those ideals, she wanted to be seen trying to achieve them. And she ultimately got out of Wytheville as a teenager. She came here to Washington, D.C. She had an older sister who was married to a local man here in Washington. And in 1890, when Washington was just booming, it was the Gilded Age here, she left Wytheville, came to Washington, and really started to kind of become the young woman she always imagined she could be. She discovered fashion and music and relied on her own brain and became sort of a personage in a big, booming, important city in a way that she had really kind of only dreamed of as a kid in Wytheville.
At a certain point, she meets Norman Galt, right? Jewelry business owner. Tell me about him and how they got together.
Norman Galt, who became her first husband, by all accounts, he was a lovely guy, maybe a little boring, maybe a little fussy, but heart of gold, absolutely devoted to her and very, very kind to her whole extended family. And he was the cousin of her sister's husband. And Norman Galt ran Galt's Jeweler here in Washington. Galt was sort of the Tiffany of Washington, D.C., the high-end jewelry and silver store, and had been here since Washington was a construction site. And so was this well-respected, deeply entrenched, high-end local business. And Norman, as its proprietor, was equally well-respected, and he sat on all the right boards, and he was, you know, an upstanding citizen. Edith dismisses Norman in like a page and a half in her memoir. She never talks about it as a love match. To her, Norman was security. He was her ticket out of Wytheville. He was her ticket to some social status and economic security. And they were married for 12 years. They had one baby who didn't survive. And she, when he died, inherited Galt, which in 1908, think about that. That was pretty unusual for a woman to own a business of that stature. And had they had children, or had Norman's father been alive, or had his brother not been an invalid, had there, in other words, been a man who might challenge her role there, she might not have been able to maintain that. But there wasn't, and so she did. And so when she inherited Galt's, and she didn't sell it, she kept it and managed it, she became a woman of a really rare status for that era. She was a widow, so she didn't need a chaperone. She didn't have kids. She had her own money, and she had control over that money. She was really beholden to no one for her own power, which was not a place that a lot of women enjoyed. And she took full advantage of it. She really loved that role. She became the first woman in Washington to get a driver's license. She was known for zooming around town in her little electric car, top speed 13 miles an hour, She was always beautifully dressed. She had fabulous hats. As you might imagine, for someone who owned a jewelry store, she had good jewelry. And she traveled every year to Europe, and she was very sophisticated and very beautiful. And a woman of, she was known around town, especially because of the car. Other people who wrote memoirs of the era remarked on her visibility, Mrs. Galt, around town in her car. And that's who she was when she caught the eye of President Wilson, this independent, attractive, stylish woman, wealthy widow of means.
So Woodrow Wilson had won the election in 1912, right? Took over in 1913, and fairly soon after lost his wife, right?
Right. Ellen Wilson died in 1914. And Ellen Wilson, Ellen and Edith share very little in common other than being married to the same man. Ellen was a great professor's wife, and that's who she thought she was going to be. Woodrow was a professor. He was president of Princeton. She was great at sort of the academic politics and hosting all those students, and she was intellectual. She was an accomplished painter. But the White House was not a natural fit for Ellen Wilson. The gossip columns talked about how dowdy her dresses were and how out of fashion her hairstyle was. And she was very shy, and that ceremonial part of First Lady just didn't come naturally to her at all. And then, as it happened, for most of 1914, she was quite sick. And when she died, Wilson was bereft, devastated. They had been married over 30 years. They had three young adult daughters. And two of those daughters, since he came to the White House, had gotten married and moved out. And the third was embarking on a singing career. She was hoping to make a name for herself as a soprano. So she was out on tour. So he was really sort of rattling around the White House alone. And he was not a man who was good at being alone. And he had a cousin, Helen Bones, who was doing whatever First Lady things couldn't be avoided. The White House was in mourning. It's not like they were throwing big parties. But Helen was there to do what had to be done. But Helen was sad and in mourning and lonesome. And Woodrow Wilson's doctor, a man named Carrie Grayson, was a good friend of Edith's. And he came to Edith and said, you know, I'm really worried about the president. He's really taking this hard. And he and his cousin Helen Bones need a friend. Will you please go make friends with Helen Bones and help with their loneliness? And Edith said, no. She said, I don't want any part of official Washington. I don't want to go to the White House. That's not my world. And Carrie Grayson said, you don't need to be part of official Washington. No one's doing anything official right now. They just need company. Go take Helen Bones for a walk in Rock Creek Park. That's all you need to do. And Edith acquiesced, and she and Helen became friends. And by March of 1915, they were seeing each other pretty regularly. They'd go for walks in Rock Creek Park, and then they'd go back to Edith's little townhouse and have tea. And one day, Helen insisted that they have tea at the White House instead, which was odd. They had never done that before, and Helen wasn't a particularly insistent character. And they had just been walking, and Edith's boots were muddy, and she really was embarrassed to go to the White House with muddy boots. But Helen insisted and said, you know, we won't see anyone. We can take the elevator straight to the private quarters, and don't worry about your boots, and let me be the host instead of the guest for a change. So Edith acquiesced, and it was a total setup. They go to the White House. They go up in the elevator. The elevator doors open, and there are Carrie Grayson and the president, and muddy boots and all. Edith stayed for tea with the president of the United States, who apparently absolutely fell in love at first sight. He was a goner from that very first moment.
So success for the plotters there, I guess. But
indeed.
but Edith wasn't sold immediately. What won her over?
Yeah, you know, she took a little while longer. And the reason we know that, in addition to her memoir, is their letters survive from that year, 1915. And it is a delight as a historian to read people's letters because, you know, they're only curated for an audience of one, and Edith and Woodrow didn't expect me to be reading their mail 100 years later. So you get this kind of unvarnished glimpse of who they really are. And I came into this project without a lot of nice things to say about Woodrow Wilson. I don't think any student of suffrage is a big admirer of that particular president. But his letters made me like him more because he's so sincere. He's, as far as I can tell, totally humorless. But he, all of his sort of moralistic, Calvinist, almost priggishness, and his intellectual snobbery, which he cultivated, it was not a put-on. He really believed those things truly in his heart. And when he fell in love with Edith, which he did hard and fast, he laid it all out there. Every letter is just gushing and fervid and sometimes even steamy because he was incapable of hiding the ball at all. He just told her what he felt from the very beginning. And she kept him at arm's length. In fact, you know, he proposed to her 5 weeks after they met, and she said no because she didn't feel like they knew each other very well. And the next day, literally the day after his first proposal, he wrote her this letter about how his heart breathes for her and how she's the model of ideal womanhood. And she writes back and says, you know, we were starting to have a really interesting conversation last night that I'd really like to get back to. Do you think William Jennings Bryan is going to resign as Secretary of State? Who do you think will take his place if he resigns? Maybe you should appoint me. This is her letter the day after his proposal. And from the beginning, she really wanted the nitty-gritty of politics. She wanted to be taken into his confidence. She wanted to know what was going on. And so he's writing, you know, I want to kiss your eyelids. And she's writing, what's going on with the Carranza government in Mexico? What are you going to write back to the Germans about sinking the Lusitania? It's really amazing. And finally, he gets it. You can sort of see him understand that she means it when she says she wants these details. And so he starts to include them more and more, and he would accompany the love letters. He didn't stop with the love letters, but he accompanied them with big, fat envelopes of, like, legislation and diplomatic correspondence and, you know, security clearance be damned. And he really came to trust her advice. He wasn't patronizing her and sort of letting her in on the big boy stuff. She quickly became one of his closest advisors, if not his most trusted confidant. He was not a man with a large inner circle at all. And he really came to her to edit his correspondence and ask what she thought he should do and what her opinion was of various players on an international stage. And that must have been awfully heady for, you know, Edith Bowling from Withville, Virginia. I think she was probably told she was beautiful every day of her life and maybe not told she was smart every day of her life. And for this famous intellect, the most powerful man in the country, to tell her that she was smart and he relied on her judgment, I think that's what finally won her over. And they were, she tried for a while to say she'd only marry him if he lost re-election. She was willing to marry him, but not the presidency. And then finally she relented and she said, I'm all in. Win or lose, I'll be your wife. So they got married in December of 1915, and she became First Lady overnight.
Let's take a brief break. We'll come back to hear the continuation of this fascinating story. The book is Untold Power, The Fascinating Rise and Complex Legacy of First Lady Edith Wilson. The author is Rebecca Boggs-Roberts. We'll have more following this brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Rebecca Boggs-Roberts. Her latest book, the new book, is Untold Power, The Fascinating Rise and Complex Legacy of First Lady Edith Wilson. And before the break, we got them married. Woodrow and Edith are married.
Right, we got them down the aisle.
We got them down the aisle. Woodrow Wilson is president of the United States when he's courting Elizabeth or Edith. She finally agrees. And as you were saying, Rebecca Boggs-Roberts, part of the deal was she wanted to be involved, right? And she became one of his closest advisors. In fact, you say that she redefined what First Lady was.
And she did it all behind the scenes. She, when she became First Lady, made it very clear she served her husband, not the nation. She didn't even like the title First Lady. She wanted to be called Mrs. Woodrow Wilson. And She would say she maintained until her death at 89 that she was not political, which seems laughable in light of subsequent events. But the way she was able to say that with a straight face is that she claimed that all of her interest was in politics, was in the service of being the best Mrs. Woodrow Wilson she could be, and that to support her husband, she needed to know his work to be able to give him good advice. I don't know that you are able to pull that off without some interest and ability on your own, not just in your husband's service, but that was how she couched it. And so throughout 1916, which was an election year, she was on the campaign trail with him. And then, of course, by 1917, the U.S. was involved in World War I. And she had to figure out how to be a wartime first lady, which is different. And she was very good at that public example part of the role. She immediately adopted all the conservation efforts, Wheatless Wednesdays and Meatless Mondays. She had sheep grazing the White House lawn to free up the landscape workers for the war effort. And, that's a very visible symbol of kind of collective responsibility. When the sheep, as sheep do, got very woolly, she auctioned the wool off to benefit the Red Cross. So she was very good at that kind of public model part of the first lady role. She never gave interviews, and she never championed causes. She wasn't, a Eleanor Roosevelt kind of a first lady. But she understood the image part. And then when the war ended and the president insisted on going himself to Paris to negotiate the peace, which was controversial, she went with him. She went everywhere with him. And no first lady had ever been abroad while first lady. Presidents had barely been abroad, not much more than Teddy Roosevelt checking on the progress of the Panama Canal kind of stuff. And so suddenly there she is on the front page of every newspaper in the world, standing right next to the King and Queen of England, up there on the stage receiving awards and keys to the city and, right there at this very important moment in history with the eyes of the world on both of them. And just by showing up, she elevated the role of First Lady. Now that public diplomacy role is very much a part of the First Lady's portfolio. But she had not been much seen outside of Washington until Edith changed all of that. And she was also necessary for sort of smoothing the way for him. So on a personal level, she was vital because he was quite shy. And he was one of those men who is very wary of putting a toe wrong. He didn't like not knowing what the protocol was or who should be addressed by what or the language. He was very insecure about being seen as correct. And Edith didn't care. Edith had figured it out every chapter of her life. She figured out, every new circumstance she had been thrown into. And so she'd kind of barrel into a situation and ask outright, are we wearing gloves to dinner? Is it, what's going on tonight? And she'd use her very bad French that she had learned from her self-taught grandmother, so her pronunciation was a little eccentric, and she'd just make it all okay for him. She charmed everybody. Her manners were so easy. She was just so good at managing a situation that Woodrow, who was confident in his ability to negotiate a treaty, but not so confident in his ability to sort of master this very formal protocol of international stage, she made all that possible for him.
One detail I just was fascinating to me. I guess there were some meetings that she wasn't allowed in, wasn't supposed to go in, so she'd hide in the drapes.
I love that story. The sort of cause of Wilson's heart was the League of Nations. The main reason he wanted to be at the table for the treaty negotiations was to try to ensure that this vision he had of this global pact ensuring world peace would make it into the final draft of the treaty. And the night that the diplomats were to vote on whether or not the League was going to be included, Edith knew how important that was to her husband, and she wanted to be there to watch it happen. But she wasn't an actual delegate, and she was a woman, and that was not really done. So she kind of threw herself on the mercy of the French prime minister, who said, okay, you can watch if you hide behind that heavy drape at the back of the room, show up before the delegates arrive, wait until they all leave to leave, and don't make a sound. But if you do that, you can spy on everybody from behind that curtain, which she did, and the measure passed, and so she got to say that she was there when, you know, the cause most important to her husband was actually enshrined in the treaty.
Yeah, shows her determination. Let's move to summer and fall of 1919. The president and his wife go on a grueling train journey, summertime. He's trying to sell the League of Nations, right? And the public's skeptical about this. I didn't know this. So October 2nd, 1919 is when he suffered his massive stroke, but I guess things were deteriorating before that.
They really were. He had gotten quite sick in Paris. It was 1918. There was a flu epidemic on, and he got the flu. Maybe not the Spanish flu, but he got a flu. And so he came back to the U.S. in the summer of 1919, already pretty weak and exhausted and sick. And so that train tour was a terrible idea. Everyone knew it was a terrible idea. You don't get take a weak, sick man and put him on a hot train car and truck thousands of miles around the country and have him shake hundreds of hands and give dozens of speeches a day. And they all tried to warn him off it, but he would brook no opposition. He thought the only hope for the League, which the Senate was opposing, was to take it to the people, to have them see the righteousness of his ideas, and then they would put pressure on their elected officials to support it. So off they all go on this train tour. It's just as terrible as everyone predicted. He's getting sicker and sicker to the point where he would have headaches that literally blinded him. And eventually, in September of 1919, the train was outside of Pueblo, Colorado, and he collapsed. And Edith and Dr. Carrie Grayson and Joe Tumulty, who was the president's secretary, but sort of secretary was his title. He really functioned as chief of staff. They had to band together and convince the president he couldn't go on, that this train trip had to be canceled. So they canceled the trip, much to the president's dismay, come speeding back to Washington, and he was sort of okay enough at that moment to wave to the crowds at Union Station and then went to the White House to rest. And Carrie Grayson is putting out these very vague press bulletins that the president is suffering from nervous digestion or nervous exhaustion, things that are really not a diagnosis in any medical way. And a week later, October 2nd, as you said, the president collapsed completely. Massive stroke. His whole left side was paralyzed. For days, his life really did hang in the balance. Even when he was out of mortal danger, he remained a really sick man. He was in bed. He slept a lot. His speech was slurred. He found it hard to follow a conversation. His concentration ebbed and flowed. He did have moments of being lucid, but he really was a sick, sick man. And according to Edith, in her memoir, which, as I mentioned, you must take with at least one grain of salt, the doctors came to her and said, if he is faced with any kind of stress, if he has to get up out of bed, if he hears any bad news, he's going to die. So basically, if he does the job of the presidency, he's going to die. If he quits, he'll die, because the only thing he's living for at this point is to see his beloved League of Nations come to reality. So if he quits, you will have removed all motivation for him to keep living. So if he's president, he dies. If he quits, he dies. And P.S., if he dies, we'll never have world peace. So those are the stakes Edith felt she was given. And in her mind, her only option was to do his job for him until he was better enough to do it himself. So with the complicity of Carrie Grayson and Joe Tumulty, they kept the extent of the president's illness totally secret from the press, from the public, from the Congress, from the cabinet, from the vice president, from the president himself. He never knew how sick he was. And Edith was the one who took all correspondence, decided who saw the president, met with the people she thought shouldn't see the president, drafted public statements. When members of the cabinet started to quit, she figured out who would replace them. She really did take the reins of the executive branch for months.
And this,
which is preposterous.
Yeah.
Right? No one voted for Edith for anything.
Right. I was going to say, this is October of 19, right? Through the, you know, the election year of 20, up until Warren Harding takes over. I can't remember at that point whether it was January or March where he would be inaugurated.
Yeah, it was still March. So it was a long time. And he, you know, the president improved, but he never got all the way better. He never got all the way better in his life. And so the amount of control Edith had to wield over the presidency, it lessened somewhat, but it never went to zero.
Yeah, as you say, she was unelected. It's an impressive feat. I mean, it's a problematic, right? But very impressive, and it says something about her, right? There's a scene in your book where you say they had to, she and her co-conspirators, if you put it that way, had to walk a tightrope. The scene is the Secretary of State Robert Lansing comes in, some senators, they're meeting with him on a pretext, but what they really want to know is what we're hearing true? Is the president well, or is he ill?
Yeah, that scene just has all the makings of a farce, doesn't it? I mean, they knew they couldn't keep putting the senators off. You know, the Republicans had taken control of the House and Senate in the 1918 midterms, and they were not interested in perpetuating Wilson's presidency. And so there was no way that Edith could continue to say, no, you can't see him. And this is in December of 1919, so just a couple of months after the stroke. So they staged this scene where they propped the president up in bed, draped a blanket over his left side and tucked it up under his chin so it wasn't obvious that he was paralyzed, put the report about the Mexican situation, which was the nominal excuse for this visit, right next to his good right hand, and did things like light the chairs that the senators would sit in very brightly, but light the bed very dimly so that no one could get a really good look at the president. I mean, it was real stagecraft. And then just kind of hoped for the best, hoped that when the senators showed up, it would be one of the president's moments of lucidity. And they walk in, and Albert Fall, the senator from New Mexico, says, I've been praying for you, Mr. President. And the president says, which way, Senator? And everyone sort of breathes a sigh of relief and thinks, you know, he's going to be on his game. It's going to be okay. And astonishingly, they pull it off. They manage to set the president up enough for the, you know, 40 minutes that the senators are in the White House to reassure them that he is going to be okay. But it really could have gone either way. I mean, it was a high-risk, high-reward maneuver, and it does have this kind of, I mean, to give a completely lowbrow analogy, sort of Weekend at Bernie's feel, where they're really just sort of hoping that the president doesn't list over in the middle of this conversation.
What aspect of this is, I don't know what would have happened if, you know, if they'd just come clean, right? Didn't have the 25th Amendment at that point, right? So the president wasn't dead.
Right.
So I don't know if thought through what would have happened.
It's hard to play a lot of what ifs with history. The vice president, and as you say, there's no 25th Amendment, so the mechanism by which he might step in was murky. He was also kind of a clown. His name was Thomas Marshall. He had been added to the ticket purely to get the Indiana electoral votes. And he kind of enjoyed that court jester role. He was great with a one-liner, and he wanted no part of the presidency. And he certainly wanted no part of being seen to usurp the presidency in any illegal or self-serving way. So hard to know, had there been a 25th Amendment and had it been clear that Thomas Marshall should have stepped in, what kind of a president he would be. I actually think the most lasting impact most impactful impact of Edith's actions was not necessarily that she did anything politically differently from what Wilson would have done. She knew his mind and his priorities quite well. It's not like she wanted to control the executive branch for her own agenda. But I actually think the most damaging thing she did was keep him in the dark, Wilson in the dark, about his own illness, and only give him happy news and continue to tell him not only that his health was improving, but that the people still loved him. And so he lost such touch with the political realities of the nation that he thought there were, you know, screaming crowds out there clamoring for U.S. inclusion in the League of Nations. He thought that, you know, he had the side of popular vote on him. He was on the side of the angels there. And he was wrong. The country had moved on. The country wanted the return to normalcy that Warren Harding promised in the 1920 campaign. And so even if Edith was consulting with the president about everything, and it's clear she was not, that even had she, his judgment was clouded because he didn't have all the information, to the point where he was deluded enough to even consider running for a third term in 1920, which is outrageous. He never would have survived a campaign, and even if he had, he never would have won it. But when Warren Harding won in a landslide, he was gobsmacked. It never occurred to him that the Democratic Party platform was that unpopular. And so I think that's the big what if. If he had been more in touch, or an acting president had been more in touch with what was going on in the nation, what would have happened with the Democrats in the 1920 election, and what sort of new initiatives might the administration have undertaken in 1920 in order to ensure their popularity?
Of course, you know, this didn't get out. You know, we didn't even have suffrage until around this time, right? So I don't know if the nation would have been all that thrilled to have an acting woman president.
Yeah, and, you know, the news kind of did trickle out, and there were a few contemporary articles about her being in control, and they were mixed. Some were condemning her, some were admiring of her. I think actually the most interesting mix comes with her obituaries. And as you say, she lived to 1961, so many years had passed since this chapter. And her role in that time is mentioned, of course, in every obituary of her, sometimes in quite a condemning, you know, this was undemocratic, unconstitutional, how dare she way, and sometimes almost admiringly, that she was, you know, the best wife a man could possibly have if she stepped in to protect him to that level. And I guess how you feel about that depends a little bit on how you feel about Woodrow Wilson and about marriage and about a lot of things. But even when people knew, the reactions were quite varied.
So Woodrow Wilson dies in 1924. Then she has long widowhood. What was she doing in that time?
She went right back to enjoying being a wealthy widow of Maine. She played that role very well. She continued to travel a lot. She stayed here in Washington, lived in a house in Calorama. And she took seriously the role of being kind of the first lady, ex-first lady here in town. Every incoming first lady, regardless of party, was invited for tea with Edith Wilson. Not for her to, you know, make them kiss her ring in some way, but just for her to kind of let them know that she knew the role of first lady was a little bananas and that she was there to help if they needed her. And then she spent a lot of time kind of burnishing his legacy. So she showed up at every statue unveiling, every time someone was naming a train station after him, every time there was some new accolade, she was there. And, you know, it's been really interesting to watch in the last couple of years as people have reconsidered Woodrow Wilson's legacy and brought up some of his more problematic aspects, his resegregation of the civil service, screening Birth of a Nation, some of his racist attitudes, that has required kind of tearing down this myth of the heroic man who had this vision of global peace. And what's been interesting for me to realize is how much of that myth we owe to Edith. She did a lot of myth-making in the 37 years after he died. And so a lot of that reputation we're reconsidering now is a reputation she built.
You write that she had certain views, maybe coming from her upbringing, which have not aged well. Of course, she lived to 61. I don't know if she, if we know she reconsidered some of those views.
It's hard to know. She, you know, was brought up with these lost cause myths. Her memoir, which was written in 38-39, talks about how the people her family enslaved were happy and didn't know what to do with their freedom and relied on her family. She told darky jokes where the punchlines were basically, you know, how ignorant black people were. By the time of her death, she had softened some of her bigoted views to the degree that, for instance, she supported Al Smith for president when she had some anti-Catholic tendencies against Joe Tumulty. So she didn't give any public statements, you know, in favor of integration or something that might point to liberality of feeling. So hard to know. But I think she did live to see the Democratic Party evolve, and she was a very, very loyal Democrat. So I wouldn't ever call her particularly progressive on social issues, but I think, you know, her anti-suffrage, racist, anti-Catholic younger self might have mellowed a little bit.
You know, the fact that we have had an acting woman, you know, a woman as acting president, we've still never elected a woman president. I wonder how you, in the, you know, 1919 up to the present day, how we reconcile that.
Right. And I will never say which Edith Wilson was the first woman president. We will have a duly elected first woman president, and I don't want to take anything away from that woman's accomplishment. It will be heroic and historic, and I look forward to seeing it in my lifetime. Edith was maybe the first acting woman president, and it's interesting to note that the closest we've gotten was the first lady, not the vice president, right? I think that shows you the inherent contradictions of what the role of first lady is. And I also think it shows you, because she was so interested in curating her own image and covering her own tracks, it shows you that women, certainly 100 years ago, made history differently than men made history. They had to kind of pretend they weren't making history. And even when Edith did this unprecedented thing, she covered it with a lot of smoke and mirrors, that it was all just about being a dutiful wife, which makes writing her biography both a challenge and a delight, because you have to kind of wade through her own smoke and mirrors, but it also makes for a really rich story that begs to be told.
Finally, you know, it's a fascinating story, obviously a fascinating woman. What's your top takeaway from having spent all this time with Edith Wilson?
You know, someone asked me recently if I liked her. And I think I would enjoy her company. She was funny. She was charming. She put everybody at ease. She, you know, could tell a good story. I don't think that's the same as admiring her. I think that, you know, what she did was unconstitutional and undemocratic, and you want the people that you respect to make better choices. And I don't want to shy away from saying that her acting as executive in those months was reprehensible. That wasn't appropriate, and, you know, could have been quite destructive. So it's, I think what you learn is she was an actual human being with all of her complexities and flaws, just like all of the rest of us. And that doesn't mean she didn't affect social change, and it doesn't mean that we should pretend she was any better than she was. But that's how history is made, by real humans, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the book is a fascinating book. It's a great read. Recommend it. Untold Power, The Fascinating Rise and Complex Legacy of First Lady Edith Wilson. The author, Rebecca Boggs Roberts, has been with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.